Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club, by the way, on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now I'm Joe Tooman, Professor of Legal and Political Communications at San Francisco State University and your moderator for today's program. And I have to tell you, I'm very pleased to introduce our special guest today, Ken Walsh, a senior White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report and the author of the book we're going to be talking about, Celebrity in Chief, A History of Presidents. I want to say, by the way, in introducing Ken, that it's a real pleasure to have a White House correspondent here because White House correspondents are, well, they're just different from other kinds of reporters. And having been a candidate for office myself that had regular press following me, they're somewhat analogous during a campaign to people who are just assigned to follow a campaign because that's the world they live in. Only the world he lives in, which is different, is the world of the people who win those campaigns. And when you are in Washington, you have to develop your own sources. You spend a lot of time on the issues that are facing Washington. But covering the White House is different in many ways because everything the president does affects everybody in the world. So the palette of colors, if you like, for you as someone who's writing, as a journalist, is broad and it's wide. And so you have to know a lot about everything. And these people are voyeurs, they're witnesses to not just world history or American history, but to global history as well. And Ken today will be talking about, as I said before, American presidents, and in particular, American presidents who have become celebrities in our time. So please join me in welcoming our very special guest, Ken Walsh.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thanks, George, for making this happen. I always love to come to the Commonwealth Club, and everybody makes you feel so much at home, and it's great to be here because also our daughter lives here in San Francisco, and she's here with us, with my wife, Barkley. So that's really nice to see. As I said, I've spoken here before, and I wanted to mention is that lots of times your questions are a lot better than the ones we ask at White House press conferences, so that's really nice to see. But I wanted to start out by saying there's been a milestone now in Washington that's just been announced in the last 24 hours, so I will make a point of letting you know about that. President Obama just started his new Twitter account, at POTUS. He used to have one called, he still has it called, at Barack Obama. Now he has the official presidential account. And the Guinness Book of World Records has now decided that he has eclipsed Robert Downey Jr. in having the most Twitter followers in one day, in the first day. It took Robert Downey Jr. 23 and a half hours to get to 1 million. It took President Obama 5 hours to get to 1 million. And the other thing, this is sort of a perfect example of the intersection of celebrity and politics and the rest of it, is that the old account, President Obama's account, had 53 million followers, 59 million followers. But it wasn't the number one account. The number one accounts were Katy Perry and Justin Bieber. So the President of the United States is third in that list. But the reason I mention that is because since I started covering the White House 29 years ago this month, the celebritization of the presidency has increased almost year to year. You know, we started out with Ronald Reagan, who was a movie star. You know, I let you to judge whether he was a good movie actor or not, but he was a movie star. He also had a television show. I'll come back to him in a minute. But in those years, we've gotten so far as our culture has become more celebrity-driven, the presidents have had to play in celebrity culture or risk losing their effectiveness. And a lot of people, traditional folks, are troubled by this because I remember when I first started covering the White House, the idea of presidents appearing on the late night entertainment shows and comedy shows was unheard of. The thought was it would lower the stature of the president. Well, President Obama does it all the time. And you might remember the big landmark in this celebritization idea was Richard Nixon when he was a candidate. You might remember this. He had lost to John Kennedy in 1960, and then he came back in 1968, and he was supposed to be the new Nixon. Well, he decided to show he was likable and sort of with it or participating in popular culture and decided to appear on Laugh-In. Remember the Laugh-In show? lot of quick cuts, quick, humorous sketches and so on. And the signature phrase of the show was "Sock it to me." Remember that? Well, his advisors decided he should just show up on the show and say those four words, "Sock it to me." And he couldn't get them right. He started off, he said, "Sock it to me? Sock it to me? Sock it." And he wasn't familiar with the show at all. So at about the eighth time, he got it right, "Sock it to me." And they used it, and it actually made a difference. People thought, well, if he's willing to participate in the show and almost make fun of himself, maybe there is something different about Nixon. Well, as we learned when he was elected, there really wasn't. So, but again, I'll come back to him again in a little bit. But I wanted to start out with this notion of celebrity in chief and sort of how I define this. There's really three parts of it that I wanted to pass along to you as sort of the thread in this whole notion. One is that I think a president, in being a celebrity in chief, there's a difference between shallow celebrity and consequential celebrity. A lot of movie actors may be shallow celebrities. Maybe they talk about politics or whatever, but they have no expertise in it. People are just interested in them really for shallow reasons because of the parts they play. But for a president, I think to be effective as the celebrity in chief, the president needs to represent some fundamental value in American life and stand as representative of that. Those values could be optimism, Franklin Roosevelt was, to some extent Reagan was, pragmatism, the sense of liberty or strength, whatever. But it has to be something larger than the person himself or herself. So that's one, the idea of capturing and representing a fundamental value or values in American life. The second is participating and understanding popular culture. This has become much more important, as I say, as we become more celebrity-driven, because people want the president to be likable, and they want the president to understand them. This is a question in polling that we watch, those of us who cover politics very closely. Which of the candidates and which president actually gets people to say, this person understands me and my life and my needs and my values and so on. So presidents need to understand popular culture and participate in it, and some do a lot better than others. President Obama, as I said, does it very well, and I'll come back to that. And then the third thing is to master the media of one's time as president, depending on what the media are. As I'll get back to in a moment, Theodore Roosevelt was the forerunner of the celebrity president for a number of reasons, but he mastered the media of his time, newspapers. Franklin Roosevelt understood radio, which was becoming the dominant media of his time. Reagan and Kennedy, television. Now President Obama, social media, and all those other things, too. So it's those three factors in the celebrity-in-chief notion that's sort of the standard that I'm using to define who's a celebrity-in-chief and who's not. Going back to the beginning, our first president was in some ways a celebrity-in-chief because he was considered the indispensable man. He was the guy who most Americans felt that nobody could run the new country other than George Washington. He had a character that was beyond reproach. He had led the country through the Revolutionary War, and he was elected president twice unanimously by the electors at the time. We're never going to see that again. That was the nature of George Washington, and he felt that he would use his celebrity to set the precedence that future presidents would use in governing the country. And he was right about that. He decided the president should only have two terms. That lasted until Franklin Roosevelt, who was elected four times, but the two-term precedent held for a long time. He also steered away from the notion of the president as royalty, because a lot of people in Congress, for instance, thought that, well, this is sort of a new office, and so we can make it what we want to make it, and maybe it should have some noble or royal flavor to it. And Washington resisted that. I remember one of the, I'm sure you're familiar with this, one of the titles that they wanted to use to describe the new president was His High Mightiness. And Washington said, that sounds great, but Mr. President will be just fine. And that's what we use to describe our presidents ever since. So Washington, a forerunner, basically. I can't talk about all the presidents, but a lot of them are in the book. Abraham Lincoln, whenever historians do ratings of presidents, really Washington, Lincoln, and Franklin Roosevelt tend to be the top three. But Lincoln was very controversial when he was president. He, of course, was not really truly popular until the North started winning the Civil War, and then he became popular. But there's one point I wanted to make about Lincoln and the notion of celebrity. When he was running for president in 1860, he understood that he needed an image refurbishment. He was known as the rail splitter. He was thought of as sort of a frontiersman from the wilds of Illinois. And so he felt he had to change his image. He gave a famous speech at Cooper Union in New York, which he knew was going to be a landmark in his campaign, and decided to have a picture taken as his campaign picture. He went into Matthew Brady's studio in New York, Matthew Brady being the famous Civil War photographer, and Matthew Brady was shocked. Lincoln came in to have this photograph taken, and Brady immediately recognized this was not a good-looking man. So they usually had pictures of the head and shoulders of the candidates in those days, early days of photography, and Brady decided he could not do that because it would show that Lincoln had a bad complexion, he wasn't good-looking. He showed up in a wrinkled suit, and so Brady decided to pull the camera back. And you can see these images if you ever care to Google this. He showed what became a very famous picture of Lincoln just before the Cooper Union speech, or that day, in which he's standing, so you got the full sense of his stature, which was a positive. He looked good in the picture, and Matthew Brady arranged to have him put his hand on a book on a table, just a subtle thing, but it made the point that this was not an ignorant fellow from the woods, and it worked. So it was sort of an early example of a president or presidential candidate understanding the need to be more of a celebrity and to have more of a positive image. And again, this is all described in the book in detail. But I think the first real forerunner of true celebrity presence was Theodore Roosevelt. Anybody who's followed, I don't know if you saw the Ken Burns documentary on the Roosevelts, a fabulous show. It's just captured, I think, Theodore and Franklin and Eleanor very well. But Theodore Roosevelt used his reputation as a military leader, a military hero, first to be elected as governor of New York and then to be chosen as vice president. He was the leader of the Rough Riders, remember, during the Spanish-American War, and they distributed photographs of him with the Rough Riders to enhance his reputation as a hero. And that worked. After he became president, he succeeded William McKinley, who was assassinated, and a lot of the people in New York State thought that they were getting rid of Theodore Roosevelt by depositing him in this office of vice president where people were never heard from again. But McKinley died, and so Roosevelt succeeded into the presidency, and he was an incredibly vigorous and animated guy. He understood that he needed to get the country on board with his program, so he channeled his celebrity to take advantage of his popularity and channel it to his policies, such as taking on the big corporations, taking on wealthy people who he felt were getting too powerful and greedy, which he called the malefactors of great wealth. And the country went along with it. He became very popular as a guy who was taking on abuses in the capitalist system. And he also channeled his celebrity to his conservation programs. There's famous pictures, really, at least of him with John Muir, the famous naturalist in Yosemite and various other places, where he was protecting federal land. So he used his celebrity in positive ways. I can't spend too much time on Roosevelt, but just a couple of other quick points. His philosophy of life really was what he called the strenuous life, that you should do everything you can in your private and public life to achieve, to succeed, and to try different things and to overcome challenges. And this is something that was closely associated with Roosevelt. He was also very interested in getting attention for himself, and I always get a kick out of the description that his daughter gave of him that very well reflects his personality and his larger-than-life character. She said, "My father, the president, wants to be the baby at every christening, the bride at every wedding, and the corpse at every funeral." So I thought that was a pretty interesting description of Teddy Roosevelt. Now, the first truly modern president, in my mind, was Franklin Roosevelt, because we had a mass media now that was taking over. We had U.S. was becoming a world power, a lot more power for the government under Roosevelt. A couple of interesting points about Roosevelt. He did come to represent the larger values of the country in fundamental ways, particularly optimism, the notion that we would, as a country, with Roosevelt's leadership, overcome the Depression, the worst economic calamity we've ever had, that we would win World War II, which the United States and the Allies did do. And he conveyed that brilliantly to the country, representing these larger values that the country wanted the president to do. He also mastered the media of his time, not only newspapers, and he understood, as frankly his cousin Teddy Roosevelt had understood, that the way to get good coverage was not to appeal to the publishers or the owners of the newspapers, but to appeal to the reporters, the people who are writing the stories. And that's what he did very well. And he would have news conferences many times. You see candidates today criticized for not meeting with the reporters enough. Franklin Roosevelt did that a lot. And he gave the reporters a sense that they were part of something bigger than themselves. And that really worked. He got a lot of positive coverage, became very, very popular. The other point about the media is that the radio was becoming the dominant medium at the time, and Franklin Roosevelt understood that, so he started doing what they called the fireside chats, which you probably are familiar with. People think he had a lot more of these than he really did. He only held about 30 fireside chats. He had a lot of other speeches and stuff, but the fireside chat is when he would speak directly live to the American public from wherever he was, the White House, his estate in Hyde Park, or whatever. And people came to look forward to these. He had a very distinctive voice, a very soothing voice. And there were reports at the time that when he gave a fireside chat, it was well publicized, so people knew it was coming. You could walk down the main street of a town or a village or a city, people would have their windows open, and everybody would have Franklin Roosevelt on the radio. And so you wouldn't miss a word when you walked down the street because you'd hear it from one window to another. Very, very popular. Another quick point about Roosevelt is this notion of the personal side of Roosevelt. He had a tremendous sense of empathy with people, and this really added to his celebrity. He, of course, had polio. He contracted polio at the age of 39, and an irony because, of course, it's thought of as a young person's disease, infantile paralysis. He contracted it, and he never recovered the use of his legs, and he struggled to recover the use of his legs all the rest of his life, but his legs were paralyzed, and his wife Eleanor said that it was this fight against polio that taught him empathy, because he understood that what it took, the perseverance it took to fight against something that was very difficult to overcome in your personal life, to overcome adversity, and he never could overcome it. So he understood the idea of struggle, which he had not understood up to this time. He came from a very wealthy and privileged background. So he understood struggle, understood empathy, and understood much better what the American people were going through in these difficult times than he would if he had not had the polio. The other thing about Roosevelt is the idea of how he affected people so vividly and so strongly. It's really, I've just gave a talk up at the Franklin Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park a couple of weeks ago, and you got a sense of the grasp he had on people and how much of a celebrity he was. By the way, he also pioneered using Hollywood stars to get endorsements and to have them associate with him, sort of a mutual aura they were trying to associate with each other with celebrity, and he pioneered that idea. I'll come back to that in a minute. But basically, by the time he died, he had a tremendous hold on the country. I thought it was a moment that happened after he passed away in April of 1945, not very long ago, the 70th anniversary. He died in Warm Springs, Georgia, at his rural therapy center there. When the funeral train was making its way up to Hyde Park, where he wanted to be buried, there were tens of thousands of people lining the route of the train, mourning Roosevelt, tremendous outpouring of grief. And one fellow who was weeping uncontrollably was approached by a reporter and asked, I see how emotional you are about the death of the president. Did you know President Roosevelt? And the guy said, I didn't know him, but he knew me. And I thought that's a wonderful epitaph for any president, and that's really the way Franklin Roosevelt was thought of during his time. So anyway, he's the person I consider the first celebrity president. Other examples of this, of course, John F. Kennedy brought glamour and excitement to the presidency. I'd be glad to talk in the question period about other presidents who I'm not covering now, such as Truman and Eisenhower. But basically, Kennedy comes into office. He's a celebrity from the beginning. People tend not to realize he learned and was fascinated by show business all his life. His father was not just a wealthy investor in New York. His father was a producer in Hollywood. and knew a lot of the stars at the time. And Kennedy watched his father operate and got to see the people the father was hanging out with. And he was fascinated by the idea of how a show business person maintains celebrity and maintains popularity and how that could convert to politics. And among the things he learned from this, his observations and his father, were the idea of using the media, of exploiting an image, which he was very careful to do. He was on, before he was even elected to the presidency, he was on the covers of Life magazine and the famous glossy magazines of the time as this rising young senator with his beautiful wife. Then he comes into office, and you remember all the pictures of the glamorous Kennedys and so on. And it really was true. He really did have he captured the country. He understood the power of television. On the value side, he's tried to capture the idea of change, of a new generation, of bringing new ideas and new energy to the White House. But the media, he understands that television is becoming the dominant media, and he's brilliant on television. You see his news conferences, sense of humor, wit, very fast on his feet. He's really a terrific television performer. Also, if you look at some of the pictures that the White House released, and I'm now working on a book about presidential photographers that won't be out for a couple of years, but basically I've come to see a lot of the brilliant pictures that they released to enhance the idea that he was a family man. Now, he had tremendous problems in his marriage, but he was actually a good father, and he would have the children come into the White House different times during the day, and they'd do acrobatics for him, and Caroline would dance for him. Little John Jr. would hide in his desk. You remember seeing that picture of John hiding in the president's desk, sort of at his father's knee, and opening the little trap door and looking out. They put these pictures out. In the past, presidents had not done this sort of thing, but he understood the importance of this image that he wanted to create, which he did do. So he was, I think, a true celebrity president and a celebrity in chief, and managed to channel a lot of that to his programs. If he had survived, you know, of course he was assassinated in 1963. We're not quite sure what would have happened, but I'm sure that celebrity factor would have been built upon by Kennedy to continue. His successor, Lyndon Johnson, was not a celebrity president in my mind and in my definition. Lyndon Johnson, the skills that he had as a senator, a very powerful legislator, did not really convert to the White House. There are pictures of him giving other people what he called the treatment, where he would literally invade their personal space. You've probably seen these pictures where he's right up nose to nose with people. And then he's doing it so much that the person is bending backward and he's almost leaning till the guy falls over. And, you know, the guy, because they were men at the time. And you can see a series of these pictures. He was just such a larger-than-life presence, but he was considered a bully and an intimidator, and it didn't convert very well to television. He didn't understand the concepts of television. The idea of being dramatic is not being oafish, and lots of times he seemed to be that way. Remember the picture where he lifted his dogs up by the ears, the beagles? He took a tremendous amount of flack for that, and he had to apologize to the country for lifting the beagles up. Remember he showed the country his gallbladder scar? Not the best television image either, but that was Lyndon Johnson. By the time he ended his presidency, both because he was not really a likable guy on television and in the media, and also because of his policies, particularly Vietnam and some of his social policies, he was widely derided. So he was sort of an anti-celebrity in chief because he would he couldn't really give speeches around the country because he'd have to deal with violent demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations. People always say to me how bad things are for the president these days and how bad they've been recently, where presidents are hated and derided. Well, boy, I remember the Lyndon Johnson era. I was in college then, and when he would go out and give speeches, he was so hated that the chant would go up, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" Now, that's pretty harsh, and that's what he had to deal with. So he was almost a prisoner of the White House in those days. So is it the other side of being the celebrity in chief. Richard Nixon, another sort of anti-celebrity. Richard Nixon did not quite understand popular culture very well, nor did Lyndon Johnson. He was a brilliant man in many ways, as was Johnson for that matter, but the country wanted other things from him. He was reelected, of course, but then we had the Watergate scandal. He never understood the power of that scandal. He never thought the country would really connect with that scandal, and he would be forced from office, but he was, and he had to resign. But a couple of just interesting stories about Nixon, one in particular about how he tried sometimes to connect with popular culture. I already told you about the laugh-in moment. He never did that again when he was president. He thought that was below the stature of the president, but not the candidate. But it came to the knowledge at the White House that a famous celebrity at the time was a real fan of law enforcement. His name was Elvis Presley. Elvis Presley decided he wanted to go to the White House and see if the president would give him a law enforcement badge so he can help catch drug dealers. Now, Elvis was an abuser of prescription drugs himself, so it's kind of a weird situation here. But he shows up at the White House, and the guard, the Secret Service guy, oh, sure, you're Elvis Presley, right. He says, no, I'm Elvis Presley. I have an appointment here. And so they let him in, and Nixon didn't really know if Elvis would show up, but didn't really want to meet Elvis. He said, well, I don't know what I'll talk to him about. I don't really know what he does. I don't know what he sings. I don't know anything about him. So they said, look, this is going to be a tremendous advantage for you in public relations. Just meet Elvis. So he meets Elvis. The situation does not go very well. Nixon really doesn't know what to say to Elvis. So the best line he came up with in the brief meeting was, Elvis is wearing, by the way, a cape, a shirt open to the navel, and, you know, jewelry, chains and all. And Nixon says to him, that's quite a get-up you have on, Mr. Presley. And Elvis says, you have your audience and I have mine, which I think is a pretty good answer. So anyway, Elvis gets his badge and Nixon gets his picture. That picture, which you could find on Google and various other places, is the single most requested picture of a president at the National Archives. And they don't look like they're getting along too well to me, but you could check that out. Again, I have to fast forward in the limited time we have, but I'm glad to address the other presidents. Jimmy Carter, not a celebrity president, by the end of his term, really too stubborn, inflexible in many ways. Both Bushes, the father and the son, are not celebrity presidents in my definition either. But then we come to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, as I said, was a celebrity before he came into the White House. He was a movie star, and he also had two television shows, Death Valley Days, you might remember this, and the General Electric Theater, where he came into people's homes as the introducer. So he was in some of the shows, but he basically introduced the show, the genial, likable everyman, and Reagan carried that off. That was the image he wanted to convey in his public life, too. An interesting convergence, again, of celebrity and so on, is he... when he was starting out as an actor, realized they were making a movie of Newt Rockne All-American about a famous coach of the Notre Dame football team. And there was a part in that he desperately wanted to play as a running back named George Gipp, based on a true story. And Reagan had played football at college, and he felt he looked the part. So he actually campaigned for it, and he got the role. And there's a key scene in the movie, which you can still find on television, where he... is in his deathbed as George Gipp, and the coach comes in, and Reagan as George Gipp says, I want you to know, coach, that when the boys are up against the wall and their backs are against the wall and they need another touchdown, ask them to win one more for the Gipper. And that became his slogan for his political career. Whenever he got into some trouble, he'd ask his supporters to win one more for the Gipper. So, again, a convergence with celebrity. He tried to go back to the Roosevelt representing optimism. He had been a Democrat in his early days, became a Republican, of course, and was able to represent optimism to the country in many ways. Of course, he was your governor here in California for two terms, and he carried that on in the White House. Very good on television. I started covering the White House in the middle of his second term, and in those days, we thought that this was a president who had really mastered the medium of his time, TV. Every day, the White House staff would get together, and they would form what they called, the line of the day. Everything was geared to the networks, the three broadcast networks, which were the dominant media at the time, ABC, CBS, and NBC. So everything they did every day was based on the line of the day. If the economy was a big issue, so if a little shoe shop in Gaithersburg, Maryland, was hiring three employees, Reagan would go there and have an event to illustrate his economic policies were working. He loved to have events, you might remember all this, with wonderful backdrops that the networks could not resist. American flags, police, children, troops. It was something the networks were sort of drawn into, and they were sort of their own worst enemies because they couldn't resist the images, no matter what he was saying. But the country was seeing the images, and Reagan actually used that to very good advantage. So Reagan was a celebrity president, mastered the media of his time, and represented that larger notion. Also had a lot of Hollywood figures who he knew from his days in Hollywood, not so much the younger stars, but stars people were familiar with. And so Reagan, again, another celebrity president. Bill Clinton, I think, fits the bill again. Bill Clinton always loved attention. He always loved the attention of people around him. You know, there's many, many stories. I don't know how many of you have ever met Bill Clinton. I've covered him for 8 years. Now I'm going to be covering him again as the campaign heats up, as what he says, he may end up being the first dude. not the first gentleman, the first dude. Okay, whatever. We'll see how that plays out. But he loved the attention. And there's a famous picture of Clinton when he was in Boys Nation. Remember, Boys State is the state-level program for high school. There's a Boys Nation and a Girls Nation. You, in high school, you're selected, and then you go to Boys Nation. I was happened to be in Boys State myself, so I'm very familiar with this. So anyway, he goes to Washington in Boys Nation, and he manages to meet President Kennedy in the famous picture where he's shaking hands with President Kennedy. I mean, there were hundreds of these young fellows all over the place, and somehow he managed to get into the picture with Kennedy, get his picture taken, and held on to it all those years and use it in his presidential campaign to show he was a guy who was sort of accustomed to fame. He wasn't sort of a bumpkin from Arkansas. And it worked. You remember also the interconnection of Clinton and celebrity. Remember he appeared on the Arsenio Hall television show playing a saxophone and wearing sunglasses. It caused a huge stir. First baby boomer president, a guy who's connected to popular culture. After he was elected, he didn't do that again, but he did find a lot of ways to get attention, and I got to know him very, very well, and everything was about him, of course, and we knew from the Monica Lewinsky year that became, he came really close to his downfall by just that desire to thinking he could talk his way out of everything, and he was such a celebrity he could get away with anything. But anyway, he was impeached by the House but acquitted by the Senate. Squandered a year, but he was such a celebrity. He was such an ingratiating guy. And anybody who knows Clinton knows he has a way about him where he can make you feel like you're the only person he's interested in a room. And he has a real gift for that. He also managed, at the end of his presidency, particularly, to persuade the country something very fundamental, that you might not like the president's private character, and a lot of people thought that Clinton was a rascal in his private character, but to assess a president, you need to separate the private character from the public leadership, and for him that meant, look at my policies, the economy is going well, we're not in a major war, and people did that. So by the end of his presidency, he was quite popular again, and he's still very popular. He's probably the most popular political figure in the United States right now, because people remember the good times under Clinton and have less memory of his character issue. Although a lot of people remember that, but they're willing to forgive him that, if not forget that, because the policies work well. So he's a celebrity in chief that made that, turned that corner that was very important to turn to separate the private from the public. Now we're up to President Obama, and then I'll talk a little bit about the campaign coming up, and then we'll take some questions and I'll sit down for a bit. But President Obama is, if anything, has taken the celebrity in chief notion farther than anyone else has. President Obama, from the first day in office, he was a celebrity, the first African American president. You remember his first year in office, he won the Nobel Prize. He hadn't done anything yet. And he said that himself. He said, I'm grateful for the honor, but I'm not sure I really deserve it. I haven't done anything. And he was right. But it was based on the reputation he had, that he would be a peacemaker, that he would work in harmony with other countries, that he'd listen to other people around the world and that sort of thing, and that he would take steps to solve this polarization problem we've had in Washington for so long now. That has not happened. And it's, if anything, the polarization is worse. Now, you can blame him. You can blame the Republicans in Congress. You can blame both of them, which most Americans do. But basically, we're just as polarized as ever. Some things are getting done, but really not on the absolute fundamentals, and lots of problems still for President Obama. But he has maintained a floor in his popularity because he has cultivated the elements of the country that liked him from the beginning and that still like him. He had essentially five pillars of his presidency with the country. He was popular, of course, with African Americans, still very, very popular African Americans, Latinos, young people, new voters, and women. One quarter of the electorate is now single women. He won twice with single women by like 50 percentage points, 40, 50 percentage points. That's a huge advantage to have with that cohort in our population. And that's going to be a big battle in the next election, by the way. But anyway, he hasn't fallen below what other presidents have fallen below when he ran into trouble because he's kept those people in support of him. But he has done things that other presidents have not done in maintaining his celebrity. I started off talking about this Twitter feed with these millions and millions of followers he has, largely from those groups I mentioned. He has also participated in the social media far more than any other president. We didn't have it nearly as much as we do now. He participates in that. He participates in communicating with people in ways that other presidents have not done. They thought it would lower their stature. He goes on the afternoon talk shows, The View, and various other things. He has appeared on Jon Stewart, David Letterman, Jay Leno, Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy Kimmel, one after another, repeatedly. Michelle Obama is the same. She is willing to go on these shows to appeal to slices of the electorate. And Obama and his people are brilliant at slicing and dicing the electorate. I'm not saying that critically, to figure out what people are interested in and how you can appeal to people specifically and how they're getting their information. More and more people don't get their information from people like me, White House correspondents, mainstream media people, news conferences, that sort of thing, interviews. They get them from social media, they get the information from the shows. You know, even though, like Jon Stewart says, he's not running a regular show. He's a comedian. He's making a lot of this stuff up. But people get their information from this. President Obama appeared, we thought, where is this going to end, when he appeared on the Zach Galifianakis Between Two Ferns show. And this was, we were surprised at this because this is a complete parody show. The host is there to make fun and insult the guest. So it was a risk for President Obama to be on the show, but he gave as good as he got. He insulted Zach Galifianakis. He was insulted back. But he used this show to make a pitch for his health care law to get young people to sign up. A lot of people, young people, are very like this show. And it worked. Young people did sign up for the health care program because of Zach Galifianakis' show. So Obama does these more and more. You remember a few weeks ago, he gave interviews to what the White House called YouTube celebrities, including a woman named Glozell, whose claim to fame was that she ate a box of cinnamon and almost threw up on the air. Now, why he would do that, that one I don't really get. But she has about 2.5 million regular viewers, so I guess he felt he had another option to appeal to another group of people. But this is what President Obama has done. Michelle Obama has done just as much. She's also a celebrity in her own right for her areas of interest, such as fighting childhood obesity, improving nutrition. She's gone on shows and danced with the hosts and so on. She gave out the Academy Award for Best Picture a couple of years ago. Talk about the intersection of the presidents and celebrity. So both President Obama have taken this to a new level, and I think presidents are going to have to do this or they're not going to be able to succeed as we become more of a celebrity-driven culture. I think the candidates who do this best in this next election are going to be the ones who are nominated, and the ones who other presidents elected is going to determine a lot about whether that president's effective by whether that president can be celebrity-in-chief and channel publicity in a favorable way to himself or herself and their agenda. Very briefly on the 2016 campaign, there are two celebrity candidates in this race now. The main one is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is probably the most famous woman in the world. She doesn't have to build her celebrity. She's got the celebrity. She has to harness it and channel it in positive ways. And so far, it's a mixed review how well she's done that. She's not met with a lot of the mainstream media. She did it this morning, actually, in Iowa, just took a couple of questions, but she's got tremendous pressure to deal more with reporters in the mainstream media. But she's trying to avoid making a mistake in some of these venues. But not taking the questions is in some ways a mistake, too. But in any case, so with Hillary Clinton, it's not so much building her celebrity, it's channeling it, and we'll see how that works out. The other two factors she has here is that she's got to deal with how much she sets herself apart or embraces the agenda and the record of two celebrity presidents, her husband and Barack Obama. This is the first time we've had a true celebrity couple running for president, Hillary and Bill Clinton. And as I mentioned, Bill is already trying to figure out what they'd call him if he's in the White House. I'm not sure first dude is going to make it, but basically he floated that. You might have seen Saturday Night Live a couple of weeks ago. They had a person depicting Hillary Clinton, who's actually very good at it, and trying to be likable, pushing too hard, being sort of brittle. And in the background, every few seconds, the character playing Bill Clinton would show up. He'd wave at the camera. He'd jump in front of her and wave and play the saxophone for a while. But that's the sense we have of what she's going to have to deal with. Can Bill sort of stay out of the limelight? And I don't think he can. I think he's going to be out there, and it's going to make things more difficult for his wife. But this is what I think Bill Clinton is going to be doing. And then the other is, of course, Barack Obama, a celebrity president. How much will Hillary Clinton sail close to his agenda, and how much will Hillary Clinton adopt his agenda? She's already trying to separate herself from both of them, by the way. She's criticized her husband's law enforcement policies by saying it led to too much incarceration, particularly of African-American men. So she separated himself from that. She's not addressed this free trade issue in quite a long time in detail, and that's the big issue in Washington, and that's one of Obama's main goals. So anyway, that's the Democratic side. She's the prohibitive favorite. I'd be very surprised if she was not the nominee for the Democrats. On the Republican side, just to wind up, Jeb Bush is their celebrity person. Not nearly as much of a celebrity as Hillary Clinton, has been out of office for more than 12 years now, is rusty, but his problem is the celebrity, that's the residue of his father and his brother, who both were president. We've never had a father and son who were president in history except for John Adams and John Quincy Adams long ago. Now Jeb Bush is trying to be the third Bush elected president in a generation. Father George H.W., his brother George W., and now Jeb. A year ago, Barbara Bush, his mother and the former First Lady, said the country has had enough Bushes. We don't need another Bush in the White House. We've already had two. And surely there are more than two families in a country of 300 million people who are capable of being president and running the White House. And it was very awkward for Jeb, who was gearing up his campaign. Now he's running, and there was an event a couple of weeks ago where he's on stage and they take questions, and there's a disembodied voice that comes out over the stage. Jeb, it's Mom. It's Barbara Bush. I changed my mind. I want you to run. Of course, he was already running then. His father and brother wanted him to run. She didn't. Now she says she does. So anyway, but he's got a similar problem to Hillary in that he's got this history, this baggage, and he's got a particular problem with the Iraq War. You've maybe read about that in the last couple of weeks. He's had a very difficult time addressing whether he would have launched the Iraq War, what he would have done, and what he would do now. And it's a very difficult thing for him because he has the family loyalty to his brother. That makes it very emotionally complicated for him to deal with this issue. And I'm not sure how it's going to work over the long term. I don't think it's worked very well so far. But anyway, he's trying to build his celebrity in positive ways to become more of a likable guy and a guy who can stand on his own without being tied to the controversial record of his father and his brother. So with that, I'll be glad to take some questions. I'm so glad you came, but I think that this notion of celebrity in chief is one we'll be dealing with for a long time as our country remains celebrity-driven and becomes more so over time. So thank you very much for coming.
And our thanks to Ken Walsh, a senior White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report and author of this new book, Celebrity in Chief, A History of Presidents. It's time now for our audience question period to begin, and we have a number of questions. So let me begin with one of my own, and we'll go through audience questions right away. Ken, much of what you described in your comments about celebrity status also referenced American culture and our obsession with this. The president at this point and the institution of the presidency is almost a global brand because everything he does or she does at some point has an impact on other countries. Barack Obama was popular in lots of countries, but I don't think it would be inaccurate to say that even Gerald Ford or Richard Nixon was also known in other parts of the planet. These people were known. What accounts for the effect of the institution of the presidency in so many parts of the world? And why is there this fascination or concern about who our leader is? Americans certainly don't have that kind of knowledge about other countries,
right.
with the exception of a few, perhaps.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think part of it is that as the U.S. has become the superpower and people look to the United States to do more things around the world, people are more interested in the president as an individual. My wife Barkley and I were just on a cruise, actually, and a number of people from all over the world, Australia, the UK, Canada, various other places, said, you know, we hope you succeed in the United States because we all have a stake in this, in the success of the U.S. You know, popularized actually during the Clinton administration as the indispensable nation. Now, some people think that's a little bit too much triumphalism, but basically I think that our president has come to represent the notion that people need the United States around the world, that what the United States does, for good or ill, Iraq War, Vietnam War, you know, foreign aid, the Marshall Plan, and all the rest of it, some things people like, some don't, but they know that our impact is tremendous, and I think that's part of what happens here with President Obama. Plus, he also persuaded a lot of people in the United States and around the world that he would be a different kind of president, a president who would listen. And I think that created a tremendous interest in him, as I said, reflected in the Nobel Prize, but I think basically people felt that this could be a different kind of American president, so people have tracked him very closely, much more than they have other presidents, I think.
Okay. Starting with some questions from the audience, and I'll wrap this around with this comment. You mentioned as one of the criteria for celebrity the ability to effectively leverage and or manipulate or make use of mass media. Mass media can be entertainment media, it can certainly be news media and traditional news media by that, and I guess today we would probably incorporate social media into that if mass is about reaching large groups of people. So, one of the criticisms that people on the right sometimes make, and that's inherent in some of the questions I'm about to read about news media, is a perception of bias, liberal bias, ideological bias. And I think they probably would make the same criticism of Hollywood, entertainment media as well. I'm not sure what they would say about social media because everybody seems to use that. With that in mind, some questions about some of the people you mentioned. First, I want this question from one of our listeners. You've covered the presidencies of Reagan and Bush, Clinton, Bush number two, as you mentioned, and Obama. In that time, it appears the media has moved further to the left. What, in your opinion, has been the primary cause for this, or do you agree with that statement? And do you envision a reversal if a Republican is voted in during the next election? Also, this question specifically about President Obama. One of the listeners said, would you comment on Obama, the politician, whose approach appears to be to denigrate in these public presentations those who disagree in a demeaning manner, including Elizabeth Warren and many others?
Okay, again, very good questions. I wrote a book about the White House and the press corps some years ago called Feeding the Beast. We are the beast in the media. And so I'm actually very familiar with this stuff. I followed this for a long time now. I think that every study of the White House press corps and for the Washington media, by the way, finds that the media are liberal, that most reporters are liberal. Most reporters vote Democratic. That's a very consistent finding for many, many years. But there's another factor there that counteracts that in my mind. I've seen this work now for 29 years personally, and that's the watchdog role. Lots of times now when reporters take the job covering the White House, the feeling is no matter what their personal politics are, the watchdog role takes over. The goal is to take down the president, take down power, speak truth to power. And this happens a lot. You know, the people who complain that we're too liberal don't often acknowledge that. Look at the Democratic candidates who have taken falls because of the media, by and large. Jimmy Carter, Gary Hart, John Edwards, one after another, people who have been run crosswise with the media, and the media took out after them. Bill Clinton had tremendous problems with the media. I mean, if you asked Bill Clinton during that impeachment year if the media were liberal or not, he hated us. Hillary Clinton still hates us because she felt that we didn't give him the proper deference and the proper sense of privacy. Now, she hated what he did, of course, with Monica Lewinsky, but she didn't think the media should have gone for it. But that's all changed now. Anything the president does is fair game. Somebody's going to do those stories. There's not going to be the sense of privacy. And so there's that. There's the idea of the watchdog role. And lots of times, we in the media aren't just watchdogs. We're attack dogs. We go for your arm, and we go for a lot more if we can. And that's what we do. And lots of reporters feel that that's their fundamental mission, is to hold presidents accountable. So it doesn't matter the personal politics of people over time. Some reporters who are the toughest on the Democrats and the liberals are liberals themselves. And so there's also that counteracting mechanism there. So that's one point. There was another part of that first question. I know the second was about Obama deriding his critics, which I'll get to.
I think the other part is if a Republican is elected, or a conservative, let's say someone right of center, do you envision something different with respect to media?
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on how the president handles the whole range of the media. And we in the media are very fractured now. You know, I mean, you've got Fox and you've got MSNBC. Fox, the conservative network, MSC, the liberal network, the mainstream media, all the social networks, the bloggers, the cable shows, one thing after another. So it's a real chore for presidents to figure out how to deal with media this time, as you say, not just news but entertainment and social media. I think a Republican would have a chance to do this. A lot of people in Washington complain that Obama has not developed relationships with people, and this gets to the second question as well. That he knows a lot of people, he will see people, he will give access to people, but he doesn't really get to know them well enough to have a relationship with them. Lots of White House reporters will agree with me when I say, when people ask, what is your relationship with President Obama? The answer is, we don't have one. Mm-hmm. He doesn't let us know him.
From Clinton in that way then?
President Clinton let us know. We got to know President Clinton, mm-hmm. Sometimes in less than positive ways for him. But I can remember many, many times having tremendous access to Clinton. He would get mad if somebody did a story he didn't like, and then he'd cut the access off, but he'd always give it back again. It was like a roller coaster. So you always knew that Clinton would come back because he loved the attention, and he thought that he could convince anybody to adopt his policies and to like him. If he was in this room, he would look for the person who he thought was his least likely to like him, and that's the person he would talk to because he thought he could convert anybody. And that's the way he was, and he had that way of making, as I said earlier, making you feel like you were the only person in the room when he was talking to you. And that was a real gift, and he still has that. Now, to come back to Obama, Obama has criticized a lot of his opponents and adversaries. They've criticized him. I mean, he's in a world where polarization causes very harsh criticisms all around, and he's had tremendous criticisms of himself. He's criticized others. But I think what you're seeing now, and you mentioned Elizabeth Warren, who's the senator from Massachusetts, very popular on the left of the Democratic Party, has taken Obama on, and he's taken her on this free trade issue, which they're still fighting about. She opposes the free trade agreement he's negotiating. He, of course, supports it, and they're at odds about this. But the problem is that at times of difficulty, This is when the relationships would matter for him. This is when Democrats should be rallying to him. This is when Republicans, who he got to know, might back off on some of their criticisms. But it's very difficult for him to get anything done because they don't trust him. The Democrats don't think he's liberal enough. He's not going to deliver for them. He's interested in his agenda and doesn't care about what happens to them when they run. And the Republicans feel he's not a good negotiator. He's not persuaded them. He'll be tough enough or whatever. And he has not built relationships with them. And that's coming to hurt him now. That's part of why he's not getting much done. He's had to resort to these executive orders and unilateral actions that circumvent Congress. The president can only get a certain amount done that way because you do need legislation in most cases. So anyway, that's the long way of saying that I think that he is willing to take on his critics. I think more and more now that he's in his last year and a half, you're seeing his true feelings come out in many ways, where he really does not think very much of a lot of his critics. You've seen some of this. He doesn't think a lot of us in the media. He doesn't think we're smart enough. He doesn't think we're interested enough in the public and so on. I mean, I disagree with that, but that's the way I think he feels. And you're seeing him express.
Wait, which part do you disagree with? The smart part of the.
I think there's plenty of smart people in the media, and I think plenty of people interested in the public, the common weal. But I think that President Obama is getting very short-tempered in some ways because he has a short time left, and he does not have a legacy item for his second term. First term, health care. Second term. Nothing comparable.
Second term healthcare.
Yeah, well, maybe healthcare. Right?
So I want to shift on to some other presidents for a moment, and then I have some questions that the audience has also about reporters as well. Some presidents in your book who got second billing, you mentioned, like Johnson and Nixon as examples. The public perception of them has maybe mellowed a little bit with the passage of time. Today, historians look at both of those men and sometimes make Shakespearean references, a Macbeth or a Hamlet, you know, tragically flawed, oftentimes self-destructive, but really interesting as human beings in some ways. A person you probably want to have dinner with just because they're fascinating, right? And so you were talking before about presidents that you like because they can empathize with us. These characters become, like characters, I guess, people, individuals that we can empathize with because they are flawed and self-destructive. Either way that you slice it, back to your notion about celebrity, is the ability to empathize or the ability to be empathized with part of what creates a fascination with a leader like a president? And is that a necessary criteria?
Right. Well, I think it is. I think the two you mentioned, Johnson and Nixon, lived during very difficult times. They were presidents during very difficult times. We talk about polarization today. We had a tremendously polarized country in those days. You know, we had the generation gap, the missile gap, the, you know, the gender gap, one thing after another. And I was just talking to somebody else about this the other day. Those two presidents, Johnson and Nixon, did have tremendous success in some ways that is historic. You know, Nixon in the opening to China, Nixon and the Environmental Protection Agency, Nixon and various other programs he had. There was also the negative side, which people, Nixon and the Southern Strategy, which is a strategy based on dividing people on race and various other things. And he also had a tremendous bad reputation for many years. His reputation was Tricky Dick. Remember, that was what people thought of him as. So it was very difficult for people to empathize with Nixon. He tried to build this notion of the silent majority. Remember that, where the great middle class. But it wasn't on a personal basis. And I think that, you know, every president is a celebrity basically when they're first elected, but then it erodes. And I think it eroded tremendously for Nixon. And he just was not considered. I think, as I say, part of popular culture, but also he was considered making too many enemies around the country in different groups, and was such a divisive figure and not a likable figure. So it doesn't mean if you're not a celebrity in chief by the time you leave office, doesn't mean you're not accomplishing some things. But I think particularly today, as this celebrity-driven process has increased, I think it is important right from the beginning for presidents to be celebrities in a positive way. I think that same applied to Johnson. And we've had other presidents, too, who had this liberty and lost it. And that's sort of what I think. Just imagine how more effective a Johnson or a Nixon could have been if they retained the celebrity and used it in positive ways, which I don't think they did.
Okay. Let me move for a moment on to talking about as being a reporter. Question from one of our listeners. How frustrating is it for you, Ken, when the spokesperson for the president or the president himself deflects difficult questions? It appears in the public that we are never get straight answers to our questions and no one accepts responsibility or, pardon me, accountability for their mistakes. How do you feel about this?
I'm asked this a lot. Lots of people say, well, you know, the president doesn't answer the questions. Why don't you press him more? Well, if you look at the presidential news conferences, the briefings every day with the press secretary, basically every question is asked, but the spokesman or the president doesn't answer it or goes off on their own filibuster. So the question you have as a reporter is, if you're in the room, how many times do you ask the same question, knowing you're not going to get an answer, you're just wasting everybody's time? If the question is asked and answered or not answered, then how many times are you going to keep asking it? And there's a lot of other things you might want to talk about. That's one thing. The second thing is, we had a lot more cards to play when I first covered the White House. Remember, Ronald Reagan would hold news conferences, and he'd make constant mistakes. He wouldn't remember who his cabinet members were. He didn't remember his own policies half the time. And we'd do stories at the end of every news conference about how many mistakes he'd made. You know, the president made 8 mistakes last night or whatever. And then he got annoyed at that, so then he started putting out questions that we had asked that were based on what he thought were wrong. So, okay, I may have made 8 mistakes, but you guys made 10, you know, that sort of thing. But what happened was people didn't care in the end. They felt the country was going pretty well and his policies were working. They didn't care how many mistakes he made and that sort of thing. So I think that, so that's one thing. You feel like a reporter, sometimes with some presidents, you do have more impact and more ability to get answers than others. I must say that President Obama does not like news conferences. He doesn't like to talk to us in the mainstream media, and he doesn't. If you see the interviews he does, and they say at the White House, well, he does all these interviews, he doesn't hold on news conference, but he's not doing interviews with the White House press corps. He's doing it with the Sunday shows. He's doing it with Glozell. He's doing it with Zach Galifianakis. I'll give him that. Fine, if that's what he wants to do. But as a White House reporter, you get frustrated because the president is not dealing with the reporters and giving access as other presidents have, and a lot of us miss that. And we feel that it's not only for us personally, which it is, but it also the country should get more information under scrutiny from the president that we would do in a news conference or an interview that we don't get to do anymore. But I must say the country doesn't appear to care how much access we have.
Let me ask you a follow-up question to that. You made a point, and I actually saw a study a week ago that made this claim, that there are more Americans today than ever before getting their news about politics from social media. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's replaced television news yet, but it's climbing. It's a much larger share.
Right.
Social media is free media. And so if you're campaigning, it doesn't cost you anything. If you're the president, it's an easy way to get stuff out. This is a natural evolution, I think, and it's a way for him, any president, to go around you, basically, because you're going to write objectively and critically.
Right.
Social media, I control the message if I put it out. Is what you're seeing from the president, having covered him, really the result of that evolution of media, or is this his personality?
Yeah.
And do you know him well enough to
right.
To
no, comment? I think it's both, but I think that he feels that in the mainstream media in particular and reporters in general, that we will play gotcha, what they call gotcha with him. We've gotcha in a mistake. They're always looking for mistakes and embarrassing. And that's true. There's a lot of truth to that. But presidents can control a lot of this stuff. Just as an example of how the president deals with a news conference, let's say. For most of the time I've covered the White House, the presidents have had news conferences and have called sometimes on 20 reporters. How many reporters do you think Obama calls on? 8 or 10? That's it. Because he has his opening statement. The news conference is an hour. The opening statement is at least 10 minutes, maybe 15. There's 45 minutes left. He calls on all the networks that carry the press conference live. So that would probably take 5 questions right there. If you have CNN, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox, that's five. I mean, if you count Bloomberg, that's six. He's got 2 to 4 questions left. He calls on an African-American reporter. Okay, perfect, entitled to do that. He calls on a liberal reporter from a liberal group, basically. Okay, now you got 2 questions left. He hasn't called on the New York Times, the Washington Post, the USA Today, US News, Time, whatever. So there's a tremendous simmering nervousness in the press corps. You're not going to get a question in. And lots of times we have questions for our own organizations that other organizations don't care about and vice versa. So maybe every question that's been asked one particular reporter doesn't care about, you've got your question. So then you don't get to it. And that gets back to the idea of the follow-ups. How much are you going to follow something up when you know you're going to have one shot and you might not get another question in a long time. You're not going to get anywhere. So anyway, what I'm getting at is presidents control these news conferences and manipulate them very well, and Obama does it very well.
Hmm. And did I detect in that there's a bias then for broadcast over print?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Owing to a broader reach of broadcast or just because they want to ask hard questions?
I think because, no, I think some of the, I think the TV people can ask hard questions, but basically the president can count on the TV reporter to preen and ask a question knowing the reporter is on camera. That's the reporter's moment. So there's a public relations aspect of the reporter asking the question. And so the president knows that some of the edge will be taken off because the reporter wants to look like it's almost a conversation with equals, that he is dealing with the president as the great journalist. And that's a very common thing, presidents seeing that. If you talk, then they resent it a lot of times that the reporters, the TV reporters, are there for their moment on the network news, and that's what it's all about for them.
If I'm reading that time right, I think we've come near to the end. Is that right? Nobody's shaking their head. They're saying it's okay. Yeah? One more question? No, he's saying it's time for the end. One more question. Good. Well, before I give the question, by the way, for those of you in our radio audience, you've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today again is veteran White House correspondent Ken Walsh of U.S. News and World Report, who is discussing the power of presidents, U.S. presidents, particularly related to their status as pop culture celebrities as well. So we have reached a point where we have time for one last question, and I want to give a question. This is kind of an interesting question, also about reporters from one of our listeners. What do you think of reporters who become celebrities? What impact does that have on their jobs?
Well, that's a very good point.
As you promote your book.
I remember about 20 years ago, some very famous political strategist said to me, you know, you guys in the media are always picking us apart in politics. You're looking at our personal lives. You're doing mistakes we made. You never let go. Someday it's going to come back on you, because you are becoming celebrities in your own right. And it has. Brian Williams, tremendous problem with the NBC anchor because he was exaggerating his personal stories. George Stephanopoulos has just hit the same wall by giving money to the Clinton Foundation. He used to work for Clinton. You've had other cases of this. Sam Donaldson has had problems with this in the past. This media, now it's the great leveler, you know, that same notion of nothing is off limits has now been turned on the media, and I think that's going to continue just indefinitely, but I think part of it is because the media people have become celebrities themselves, and so everything is fair game.
I noticed you didn't mention Bill O'Reilly, but...
Well, okay. I mean, I'm an even-handed critic, so sure, I'll mention Bill O'Reilly.
Okay. Our thanks to Ken Walsh, senior White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and again, author of this new book, Celebrity in Chief, A History of U.S. Presidents. Go out and buy it and read it. It's a great book, and talk to your friends about it. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Now I adjourn this meeting of the Commonwealth Club.